Okay, the causes of homosexuality. Let me save you about an hour here. We don't know the cause. I thought I'd give you the bottom line first. We don't really know the cause of homosexuality. So if you want to just skip the next hour, go home and say, I got the main idea out of the talk. You can leave now. So since we don't really know the cause of homosexuality, what I want to do for the next few minutes is to try and shape the way that you think about the causes of homosexuality. I think there are good ways and bad ways of approaching the issue, and hopefully I'll give you a good way that will help you to be understanding and empathic and help you to form good relationships with people who do struggle with homosexuality. Also, I hope that this is very scientific in the sense that it helps you to understand all the truth claims that are out there about why people are gay or lesbian. So, the first way that I would like for you to think about psychological problems or any behaviors, actually, behaviors in general, is I would like for you to think that they are very complex. Human behavior is very, very complex. And sexual behavior especially is amazingly complex. It's so complex that we've not been able to figure it out yet. In truth, especially in human beings, there are few behaviors of any type that have just a single cause. Most behaviors are in fact multi-determined. And when you take something that is as variable as sexual behavior, we're talking about an area that has many different levels of complexity. Just to give you an idea of how complex it can be, we have a hard time defining homosexuality. In fact, I believe that there are probably several different types of homosexuality. We talk about it as though it's just one thing, but it's probably not just one thing. To use some other psychological parallels, depression. We know, for instance, that there are many different types of depression. Or when we think about a disorder like schizophrenia, schizophrenia is probably a name that we give to several different disorders, but we're not very good at distinguishing them yet, so we've not been able to separate them out. So I just put up here the Klein Sexual Orientation Grid, and this is one researcher's attempt to classify a person as to whether they're homosexual or not. So you can see that we ask questions like, what is this person's sexual attraction? Is it same sex or other? How about their behavior? Is their behavior with same sex or with other sex? What kind of fantasies do they have, same or other? What's their emotional preference? What's their social preference? What's their self-identification? What's their lifestyle? You see, different homosexual people will score differently on this grid. You'll see different patterns of people. And yet we tend to clump them all together as homosexuals when two homosexuals might actually be quite different from one another in a variety of these areas. So we have to be careful about that. A simpler division of what is homosexual was used by Lauman, Gagnon, and others in the famous National Health and Social Life Survey in the early 90s, sometimes just called the Chicago Study, which was one of our very best studies on human sexuality. And they tried to reduce all the things that Klein was talking about down to just three variables, and that is desire, behavior, and identification. When we look at homosexual behavior, we ask, okay, who are you attracted to, same sex or other? Who do you actually engage in sexual behaviors with, same or others? And how do you identify yourself? Do you identify yourself as straight or as gay? And that makes it a little simpler, but you can see that it's still a very complex issue. And that even on these three basic issues, people vary. For instance, I see people who engage in sexual and same-sex behavior but don't identify themselves as being gay. And I see other people who identify themselves as being gay but have been celibate for a long time. So keep in mind the level of complexity that we deal with, and remember that human behaviors are multidimensional. They have many different aspects to them. And that makes them difficult to study and difficult to conceptualize. Another way that I'd like for you to think about basically all human behavior, but especially sexual behavior, is to take an integrative approach. I think the best approach to understanding behavior is to be integrative. And by that, I mean look for multiple contributors to the behavior. Look for multiple contributors. And by that, I mean things like biological contributors, psychological contributors, social contributors, developmental contributors. All those things go together to make us who we are, whether you're homosexual or heterosexual. Just as human beings, as persons, we are the product of many influences. And if you want to understand a person, you have to understand those different contributors or those different influences that make us what we are. To get it right, to understand how those influences or those factors come together, we need to have a recipe. And fortunately, I have a recipe here. Actually, this is a recipe for a highly touted cake. And look at this recipe. You know, what does a cake consist of? Cake consists of, this particular cake, consists of 2 cups of flour, 1.5 cup of sugar, 3.5 teaspoons of baking soda, teaspoon of salt, 1/2 cup of shortening, cup of milk, tablespoon of vanilla. I hope that's not too much. Four egg whites. And then once you have these basic ingredients, what do? Mix them together, put them in a greased pan, and you... I left out the preheated oven there. But you preheat the oven, and then you bake it for about 40 minutes at 350 degrees. Okay, pretty straightforward. I often ask my class, what's the recipe for a cake? And none of them seem to know. They always say, just get the box. You know, just get the box and put it in the oven. So we may need seminars on this. But if you want to get a good cake, you have to follow the recipe. Now, what if I told you a cake? You want to know what a cake is? A cake is flour. If you want a really good cake, you've got to have flour. And that's all you need. It's just flour. That's a cake. Well, someone else would say, no. Sugar. Cakes are sweet. It's not a cake unless it's sweet. So you've really got to have sugar. Sugar is what a cake is. Well, obviously that's not true. If you try and bake a cake all out of sugar, it's not going to be a very good cake. You need different ingredients, and you need those different ingredients in different proportions. And in fact, notice that the different ingredients are quite different from one another. Like flour is not very much like vanilla, and milk is not very much like egg whites. So the ingredients are actually quite different from one another, and they're combined in different proportions. It takes more flour than it does sugar. Notice as well that in baking a cake, there's a certain sequence involved. If you cooked each ingredient at 350 degrees for 40 minutes before you combined them, what do you think you would get? I'm not sure either. But I have a feeling it wouldn't be the cake that I'm thinking about. So you see, in just a commonplace recipe, we have to have different ingredients in different proportions, and they have to be combined in an optimal fashion. Well, that's just a cake. But when it comes to human behavior, I think that it's very much the same. In fact, how many of you have taken statistics? All right, that is very encouraging. How many of you are going to take statistics? Well, that's more encouraging yet. Okay, I've basically just tricked you. You know, I lulled you into talking about cooking and recipes. But really what I'm talking about here is statistics. And this is why so many of you have to take statistics. If you really want to understand things, and especially if you want to understand people, you have to learn formulas. Or what's another word for a recipe? A recipe is a formula, or we could even say that it's an equation. That's right. A recipe is really just an equation. The ingredients are the variables, and the amount of ingredients are simply the coefficients. So if you have the right variables in the right proportion, you get a predictable outcome, like a cake. But that's the way it is with human beings and human behavior, too. If you can figure out the contributors, figure out the proportion or the weight or the importance of each, and combine them in the optimal fashion, you probably can predict behavior. At least that's our ideal. That's the model that I have in my head, and that's the way that I see psychological or behavioral research going. Now, a third concept that I want you to get in mind. We've got multidimensional, we've got integrative. The third concept I want you to get is equifinality. Equifinality simply means that two individuals may arrive at the same point by a different route. For instance, if I said, hey, let's go out to Panera after this. You say, well, which one? I say, let's go to Panera in Beaver Creek. All right. You might wind down Bridge College Avenue to Bridge Street to Wilberforce Clifton to Grinnell to Clifton to 68 to wherever it is. You might go that route. I might just shoot out to Xenia on 42 and then take 35 to Fairfield Road and go that way. We would be taking quite different routes, but hopefully we would both end up at Panera. That's the concept of equifinality. Two people arrive at the same destination by different routes. We have to remember that individuals are unique. We do not have the same history. You know, if you look at your brother or your sister, you're raised in the same family, and yet you've had quite different life stories. And you've had different histories, even though you've been in the same home. And it's even, our stories are even more diverse when we come from different communities and different backgrounds. This is why we have to be really careful not to stereotype people. We shouldn't stereotype anyone, but we need to be especially careful not to stereotype homosexuals, because they may have arrived where they're at by different routes. They may have different types of homosexuality, and they may have traveled different paths to get where they're at. And so when we clump them together, or when we say, oh, homosexuals are, and then we lump them all together, we don't like that. They don't like that any more than we like it when people say, oh, you're a Christian, you're just like all those other denominations. You know, we distinguish ourselves by denomination, and we distinguish ourselves by the view that we take of the Bible. We don't like to be clumped, so don't stereotype. Now, the reason that we have equifinality is because among those many variables with their different coefficients, we have interactions. That means those variables interact together. And I've tried to display that on the next slide. Oops, sorry about that. There you go. With this diagram. Now, for the moment, and again, just for the moment, let's suggest that family dynamics can make you more or less at risk for homosexuality. Let's suppose that if you have, like if you're a boy and you have a domineering, close binding, controlling mother and a distant, aloof, emotionally uninvolved father, let's assume that that family dynamic makes you more prone to homosexuality. So you have a risk factor. In other words, you're more at risk. If you don't have that kind of family, you're less at risk. Well, you can see that that one variable may heighten or lower whether you're going to be a homosexual or not. Let's add another variable in. There have been some recent studies by Bogart that suggest that younger born sons are more likely to become gay. In other words, the more older brothers you have, the higher your risk factor for being gay. So let's suppose that you've got older brothers. So you have a higher risk factor for being homosexual, and that's opposed to a person who's maybe firstborn or doesn't have older brothers. Well, you can see the interaction here. See, if you have both risk factors, if you have the bad family dynamic and you're younger born, suddenly you're looking like you're more at risk. If you have neither of those, you're real low at risk. But if you fall in the middle, you're somewhere in between. But notice, the two people that are in between have different risk factors. Do you see that? One's vulnerable because of his family dynamics. Another one's vulnerable because of their birth order. But they're both kind of mixed. So this is at least a brief illustration of equifinality. They got to the same place, but because of different variables in their life. Let's take this one step further. And we'll throw in trauma. Let's suppose that if you experience sexual trauma as a child, that is, if you're molested or somehow sexually victimized as a child, you're more at risk for being homosexual. We'll just suppose that for the moment. If that doesn't happen, you're less at risk. Now, look at our factorial here, and notice that we've got 8 different conditions. We've got 3 variables, or 3 risk factors. And those risk factors are simply more at risk or less at risk. But we've got 8 different outcomes from that. Now you can see that if you have that domineering mother and aloof father, and you have older brothers, and you were traumatized as a child, you've got 3 risk factors. If you had none of those, that would be the sector in the back there, you're probably very low at risk. But you see, we've got 6 other conditions. And you understand that in those 6 other conditions, we've got 3 that are plus, plus, minus, and we've got 3 that are minus, minus, plus. So we've got 2 groups of 3 sectors, or we got 2 sectors, and their risk is about equal, but their risk is from different variables. So this is equifinality. 2 people can have the same behavior or have the same problem, but get there different ways. This may be clearer to you if you think about depression. 2 people may be depressed, but they may be depressed for quite different reasons. But they're still both depressed individuals. It's the law of equifinality. All right, is that somewhat clear to you? This is the way I want you to think about homosexuality, and in truth, it's the way I want you to think about all behavior. Now, let's go on and look specifically at homosexuality and some of the contributors to it. Now, what did I say about causes? What's the cause for homosexuality? We don't know. So now, I'm going to talk to you about some of the things that we think might contribute. But no one of these alone, to our knowledge, causes a person to be homosexual any more than you can make a cake out of just flour. So please understand, these are things that, think of it as the direction that research is turning. All these are areas where researchers have looked and found some interesting evidence. But notice it's just that. It's interesting evidence, but it's not hard proof. So, let's look first at biological contributors. Biological contributors. They tend to fall into three categories. They fall into the category of genetics, prenatal influences, and brain structure. There's been research in all these areas. So let's look at genetics first. Very simple genetic principle is this. You know, monozygotic twins, that those are identical twins, those are twins that share 100% of their genes, or their chromosomes, I should say. And fraternal twins, those are not identical twins, they share about 50%. So a basic principle in genetic research is that if a behavior is truly genetic, if it's caused by genetics, there should be a 100% concordance rate. If there's a gene that causes a difficulty, then both twins of the monozygous twins should have that behavior or that characteristic. And if not, if it's less than 100%, genetics may contribute, but it's not solely caused by genetics. And in all cases, the monozygous twins should be higher in concordance rates than our dizygotic twins, who share less genetics. Well, there have been studies on looking at gay twins, where one twin is gay, and whether, then we ask the question, does that person have a concordant monozygous twin, and are those pairs, do we see those at higher rates or lower rates than we see fraternals? And the research on this, to this point, has shown that, yes, there is some concordance among monozygous twins. But while that's interesting and that raises our suspicions that there might be genetic factors at work, the concordance rate is seldom much above 20%, which means that while genes might play a role, maybe, we're suspicious that they do, genetics are not the main contributor to homosexuality. Let me go to another interesting study. There was a famous study a number of years ago by Hamer, in which Hamer studied some homosexual men who had a history of homosexuality on their maternal side, that is their mother's side, and who also had a gay twin. And he looked directly at genetic samples, especially at the X chromosome, because he was interested in the maternal side of things. And he found that, indeed, homosexuals in the condition that I just mentioned had a higher correspondent rate genetically with a certain segment of the X chromosome. They had a higher correspondence with their gay twin than with their non-gay twin. And that led him to believe that, you know, maybe there's something on the X chromosome that influences or contributes. But once again, the rates for that are not very high. And they're not high enough to be compelling us to believe that genetics are the only or even the main contributor. And then another genetic study that's real interesting, and it goes just in the opposite direction, is a study by Behrman and Bruckner, who actually found, in looking at a number of different types of twins in regard to their same-sex attraction, They looked at different sibling patterns and looked at how every combination of sibling pattern was related to same-sex attraction later in life. And what they found was kind of confusing, because they found something that contradicted the previous studies, and that was they found that in opposite-sex dizygous twins, that would be where you have twins, but they're brother and sister and not identical. They found that that was the condition in which he found the most same-sex attraction. Now, everyone who was thinking down the monozygous route looked at that, scratched their head, and said, where is that coming from? The overall rate for the other twin and sibling rates for same-sex attraction was about 7.5%. And in this one condition where there's opposite-sex dizygous twins, the rate of same-sex attraction was almost double. Well, it was over double. It was about 16-17%. Well, they looked further, and Behrman and Bruckner found that this effect, this heightened same-sex attraction, was wiped out if these dizygotic opposite-sex twins had an older brother. Okay, now how does that work? What Behrman and Bruckner concluded was this. They concluded that this was not a genetic issue at all. Well, not very much. What they concluded is that this is really a matter of socialization of boys. In fact, they called it incomplete gender socialization. And what they meant by that is when a couple of parents are presented with twins, one's a boy, one's a girl, they probably do a better job socializing the girl than they do the boy. And so the boy is more likely to have same-sex attraction subsequently. But where does the older brother come in? If there's an older brother in the family, the parents have already had experience in socializing or raising a boy, and plus the influence of another boy in the household may provide a model for this boy to be socialized properly. Well, okay. Genetic research at this point is very complex. It's contradictory often. There are some effects there, but the effect sizes are small. And many of these studies have not been replicated, and many of these studies have very suspicious or questionable or inadequate samples. But they're interesting, and they raise very interesting questions, and I think that these are areas that are well worth looking into on a continued basis. Now, let's look at another area, and I think this is actually a more interesting area, and I think this is probably a more promising area. And it's another biological area, but this has to do with prenatal influence. And by prenatal influence, I mean this is the influence on the developing child in the womb. One of the areas that's really hot right now in research, and again, very interesting, is could same-sex attraction be the result of hormonal influences while we are developing? And there's some interesting evidence for this. There have been a couple studies out in the past. There was one very distant study that found that mothers who were pregnant in very stressful times, like, for instance, women who are pregnant in war zones, for instance, in revolutions, like in Germany or in the Blitz in England during World War II, some researchers thought that there were a higher number of children born with same-sex attraction to women whose mothers had been stressed. And they inferred from that, and again, those are not controlled studies at all, and those studies haven't held up very well over the years, because they're at best correlational, and they're, again, they just lack in control. But they raise the question of, could the stress hormones that a mother experiences ultimately affect the attraction of her children? Well, more direct evidence of that came from the follow-up of DES. DES is a synthetic hormone, diethylstilbestrol, and it's an estrogen agent that was used to help prevent miscarriages. But there were problems with it, and it wasn't used after 1971. But some researchers followed up the children who were born after their mothers had taken DES, these estrogen hormones. And what they found was that about 30% of the girls who had been exposed to the DES reported themselves as being either lesbian or bisexual. And so that raised the suspicion that maybe hormones have a role in this, especially early on. If we look at androgens, male hormones, there are a couple disorders that occur in people. One is congenital adrenal hyperplasia, in which too much androgen is secreted while the child's in the womb. That doesn't affect boys at all, but for women, it raises the chances that they are going to be bisexual or lesbian. Androgen insensitivity disorder, AI, is a disorder in which a genetic male doesn't have the receptor sites for androgens, and so they are not masculinized by the male hormones. And even though these people are genetically males, they're XY males, they look like females because they're not masculinized, and most of them go on to live their lives as females, even though they're genetically male, and that is basically a hormonal issue. Okay, another study that's kind of that's very interesting, and this is a real hot controversy right now. It's the Bogart studies on fraternal birth order. As I mentioned earlier, there's some indication now that later born sons are more at risk for same-sex attraction. One explanation that is given for this is that with each successive pregnancy, the mother forms more antibodies against an antigen that's on the Y chromosome of the fetus. And so each time, with each male pregnancy, the mother has more and more antibodies, and that may impact the fetus in a way that shapes the brain or shapes some aspect of that person's biology to make them more prone to be same-sex attracted. Now, again, there are other explanations for this. Maybe if you have more older brothers, you get picked on and bullied more. So this is not an exclusively biological argument, but it's often used as a biological argument. I keep saying this is interesting. These are all interesting to me. But we know there's a correlation between homosexuality and handedness. Homosexuals are more likely to be left-handed. I have to do this carefully. What am I doing this for? I'm doing this because we also know that homosexuality tends to be correlated with finger ratios. In men, men's index fingers tend to be shorter than their ring fingers, whereas women's tend to be more equal. And for male homosexuals, that tends to be reversed. They have a lower ratio than men do, which is interesting. put your hands in your pockets. But what you can't hide is that Martin and Nguyen lately have found that when you look at heterosexuals and homosexuals, the bones in their arms and their legs are of somewhat different length. In other words, the ratio lengths of their bones vary in both males and females from homosexuals and heterosexuals. Well, why would that be? I mean, that's a weird thing. But remember that bone growth is to some degree determined by fetal androgens and estrogens. So once again, they think, this may have some hormonal connection back there in the developing fetus. So those are many interesting things. Temperament, psychologists have been increasingly convinced that certain temperaments are prenatally determined, especially aggressiveness and activity level. We know that certain people are just born with certain temperaments. And probably hormonal, but for whatever reason, that is a biological given. And there are many animal studies that I'm not even going to take the time to go into. Obviously, with human beings, you can't do controlled studies of these things. But with animals, we can subject them to high levels of hormones, or we can deprive them of hormones and notice how they develop. And there are a bunch of studies on that. So those are all possible, you got that? Possible biological contributors. We're not saying that any of those are a surefire thing. There's some evidence for each of those, but there are problems with all those studies. And those studies would need to be replicated many times for us to say, I don't think we'll ever say this is the cause, but that this is a major contributing factor. All right, brain structure. I'm just going to deal with that quickly. The brain structures that have most frequently been studied are the interstitial nucleus of the anterior hypothalamus, the various regions 1 through 4 of that have been studied. There are mixed and contradictory findings of that. Sometimes a male's INAH region is more similar, a gay male's region is similar in size to a straight female's more than it's like a straight male's. Sometimes it's not. There are a varying number of studies out there, and I can't even draw a conclusion from it, but I want you to know that that is being studied. And why that's interesting is because we think that the impact of hormones in the uterus may actually determine to some degree brain formation and development, and that would possibly explain the different size of a particular brain region. Other areas that have been studied are the anterior commissure, which is the connection between the right and left hemisphere of the brain, and then also the suprachiasmic nucleus, which is a part of the hypothalamus. And once again, the studies on these things tend to be small samples. They tend not to be replicated. And the samples are often very suspect samples. But they raise questions that biology may be involved. All right, enough biology. Some of you hate biology, so let's get out of there. And go to psychological and environmental contributors. You're probably more familiar with these. Now, I already mentioned one, and that would be parenting patterns. How do parenting patterns contribute? Well, the classic parenting pattern I've already described to you, it actually grows out of psychoanalysis. This is one concept from psychoanalytic thought that's hung around a long time, long after Freudian has passed off the scene, this particular idea persists, and that is that close binding mother with a rejecting, absent, detached father contributes to the development of same-sex attraction for boys, I should mention. This is simply for boys. Notice that there's a lot more research on male homosexuals than on female homosexuals, and that's still a problem out there. We can say more about male homosexuals. We don't know so much about lesbians. I think we can all see how this pattern might contribute to a son's distress. In recent years, emphasis has been placed more on the father and the importance of a father and a father being emotionally present. In the early days of this theory, more emphasis was placed on the woman. And, you know, if you go to therapy, there's an old joke. I mean, what do you do when you go to therapy? What do you talk about? Who do you blame? Blame your mom. Yeah. If you don't know what to do in therapy, just blame your mom. That's the psychoanalytic theory. You go and say, you know, mom just stifled me. Okay. Not really. I'm teasing. But that's the psychodynamic heritage, I'm afraid. But in recent research, we're recognizing the importance of fathers. And as you read these studies about, are there things in the parental pattern that influences kids? It's having an emotionally present father who's involved in the family. Okay. Another psychological factor is being sexually abused. In the famous Chicago study, which again is one of our very best studies, I think one of the most sobering findings in that whole study is that being sexually abused as a child basically tripled the rate of same-sex attraction. And in fact, now realize these are not high rates, but Lauman, Gagnon, and others in that study found that 7.4% of men and 3.1% of women who had been sexually abused reported a homosexual orientation later in life. Of people who had not been abused, it was 2% of the men and less than 1% of the women. So I think very important and very sobering statistic. But let me go back to the original premise of what I'm saying here, is that not all homosexuals have been sexually traumatized. Not all gay men have been abused as children. So while this increases the risk factor, childhood sexual abuse is not a sole cause, because we all know people who have been sexually abused but are not struggling with same-sex attraction. So it's a contributor, but it's not a sole cause. Let me go on to an interesting theory proposed by Daryl Bem, which is sometimes labeled EBE, or the exotic becomes erotic. This is a theory of psychological development that perhaps might explain some contributors to same-sex attraction. Bem says that in our societies, which are largely gender polarized, especially a child's world, tends to be organized into they're the boys and they're the girls. Boys and girls tend to be treated differently, and they tend to be segregated. They engage in same-sex play, and you know, it's you don't want to, if you're a boy, you don't want to be a girl, and girls think that boys are yucky or whatever, and they're polarized in that sense. Well, occasionally, a child comes along who is not gender conforming. Because of his or her temperament, he or she doesn't fit in with their same-sex peers very well. In fact, here's a flowchart for it. Now, remember I said that temperament is to some degree, not solely, but to some degree, biologically determined? Well, if for whatever biological reason, a child's temperament is not gender conforming, let's suppose that we have a boy whose temperament is not aggressive and active, but it's rather It's rather passive and rather quiet. So he's around his same-sex peers, and he doesn't fit in very well. He doesn't feel very comfortable with them. They're different to him. He actually feels more comfortable with the girls. So he plays with girls, and he actually, instead of feeling different from the other sex, feels different from his own sex. Well, we know from theories of arousal that we tend to get aroused by people that are different from us. One of the joys of high school, maybe junior high school, college, you're around, if you're a boy and you're around girls, it's just, they're so mysterious, you know, they're so strange. It's like, you get a little apprehensive, maybe butterflies or something around them because they are rather exotic to you. And because they're exotic, because they're different, because you have some level of uncertainty and apprehension about that, over time that probably becomes eroticized. And so you're attracted to what's different from you because it's stimulating and challenging. But, see, if you were gender nonconforming as a kid, it's not those people of the other sex that are different to you, it's people of your own sex. And so maybe you get eroticized to that. Interesting theory. Another possible contributor to same-sex attraction would be being psychologically vulnerable. Psychologically vulnerable. That just simply means having problems or having troubles or having deficits in some area of your life. For instance, it might be just being very, very lonely. If you are very, very lonely and have been isolated, alienated perhaps, you haven't had many friends, and then someone of the same sex comes along and befriends you, you're really going to like that. You're really going to enjoy that. You're really going to just latch onto that person, most likely. And if indeed you've been isolated and alienated most of your life, and this person offers you friendship, that friendship may get eroticized. You may be kind of mixed up about that because you don't have much friendship experience. And so sexual elements enter into that friendship, and the relationship gets somewhat confused, and you may feel sexual feelings or even identify yourself as being having same-sex attraction. As I was thinking about this, I thought about what Anna Salter wrote in her book about pedophiles, which is a very scary and depressing book. But Anna Salter interviewed lots of pedophiles. She's a forensic psychologist, and so she goes around and does evaluations on these people and interviews them. And the pedophiles said this. The pedophiles said they knew how to pick victims. They knew how to pick kids to molest. And they said things like, well, I always look for the needy kids. I always looked for the picked on kids. I always look for the kids that lack a happy home life, because those kids are more suggestible, they're more influenceable, and they're not likely to report. They're not likely to tell on me. I look for kids that are easy to manipulate, and it's the unloved kids that are most responsive and most willing to go along with the pedophile's suggestions. Well, those are obviously characteristics of psychological vulnerability, and that explains the victimization of some children to pedophiles. It also shows how crafty and how honed pedophiles' skills are in identifying victims. So it may be that some persons are just more psychologically vulnerable, and therefore, because they're more suggestible, they can be more easily led into same-sex relationships or even into believing that they are homosexual. Another thing that happens every day, every time I hear it, it just makes me cringe, but I hear people saying, queer, faggot, sissy, I mean, I hope you haven't heard that, but I've heard it now and then. The impact of labeling is very powerful, especially at an early age. When a kid gets labeled with those labels, it's confusing. I mean, if your friends call you those names, you think, is it true? I mean, I had a student come to me just recently and talking about being labeled that way. And, you know, it makes you stop and think. It's like, who am I? How am I coming across? What are people seeing in me that makes them think that of me? And you know, when you're labeled, at first you resist the label, but then it gnaws at you, it eats away at you, you begin to wonder, well, am I? And then what happens? You begin conforming to it. Well, if they all say I'm this way, I may as well act that way. And then what happens? You act that way a little bit, and someone out there comes along and seduces you, or entraps you, or becomes a powerful influence in your life and leads you into some activity that you otherwise wouldn't have done. So this is a social explanation of a contributor to same-sex attraction. And again, the exotic becomes erotic because you got labeled and you now see yourself as being unlike your peers, that other sex or that same-sex attraction looks maybe more attractive. Culture. How does culture impact us? Well, you don't have to look very far to see how culture is becoming increasingly gay-affirming. I had a youth pastor the other day say, hey, what's going on with the guys in my youth group? He said, these guys in my youth group are all, you know, hugging on each other and rubbing each other and going around touching each other a lot, and that's supposedly cool. And he said, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. But the consensus was they got it from TV. That's the way guys are increasingly being portrayed on TV, I guess. So that's just one mild cultural influence. And I'm not saying that's a bad behavior. I'm just saying it's no doubt a response to our media and culture. One of the things that I think is especially noteworthy is the fact that a number of organizations are in our culture are promoting the early identification of sexual orientation, and especially the identification of oneself as being gay. In the schools, with the diversity training and are sensitizing teachers and guidance counselors to recognize and affirm gay students, what we're doing is we're beginning to try to identify people as gay, even in elementary school, certainly in junior high and high school. And many, many kids are mixed up about everything sexual in adolescence, and gender identification is one of those things that people wonder about and struggle through, and especially with all the media hype and attention now. And certain teachers, guidance counselors, school systems, gay advocacy organizations are saying, label them young, so we can spare them, so we can preserve them, so we can provide a gay support group for them, identify early. And I think culture in that way is contributing to more persons being same-sex attracted. Models, there are models, more and more models of gay persons in our culture, which obviously attracts people to thinking that homosexuality is a normal variant, a healthy sexual orientation. Do you know what LUG stands for? Any of you use that term? Okay, some of you know. Lesbian until graduation. Have you ever heard that? Please, this is just an example, but sometimes in sports, girls will go into university sports, and other members on the team are lesbian, and perhaps the coaches are lesbian too, and there's a strong lesbian culture there. And girls, you know, just because they're surrounded by other persons, they have role models that they value and have to work with. You know, that's just a cultural influence of models that may influence some persons to try a lesbian lifestyle. I'm just using a female example in this case. There are many other examples of that. University settings tend to be tend to have many homosexual models for kids to follow, in professors, coaches, and other official personnel there. So just the simple effect of modeling, which you all know about. And of course, urban. Rates of homosexuality are higher in urban settings than they are in rural settings. And so the urban influence is definitely a factor, I think. Let me basically sum up this part of it by showing you a study from Denmark by Frisch and Havid. Gay marriage, or same-sex marriage, has been legal in Denmark since 1989. And they could not look directly at individual homosexuals, but they could look at marriage rates and interview people who had been involved in gay marriage. Here are the characteristics in Denmark, and this was actually done on something like 2 million Danes, not that many were homosexual, but on the gay marriage sample out of the Danish population studies, because every marriage is registered in Denmark, when they looked at the characteristics of persons who are involved in lesbian or gay marriages, they found these characteristics. They found that for men, and again, these are correlations, not causes. These are just other factors that tend to be associated with people who are involved in a same-sex marriage. It's older mothers, for men, older mothers, divorced parents, absent fathers, being the youngest child, and being urban-born. Those were the correlates of males involved in homosexual marriage. The characteristics of women were maternal death during adolescence, being the only or the youngest child, or the only girl in the family, and being urban-born. That's an interesting picture, isn't it? And those are like psychological, social, cultural things. But, again, you will find people in gay marriage who are none of those things. But just the fact that they're correlated tells us this would be an interesting area to look, to find one of the ingredients in what it means to be gay. Okay, last slide. Here's the summary. If you take what I'm saying and if you understand it the way that I'm trying to present it, this is what you'll come up with. Behavior is very, very, very complex. We don't understand behavior very well. Behavior is multi-determined. It's the product of many contributors. Third, the same behavior in two individuals may have quite different causes. That's the principle of equifinality. So don't stereotype. Not all people with the same situation are alike or got there by the same route. Fourth, we need a recipe. We need a formula. We need an equation that simultaneously gets all the ingredients in the right proportion and in the right sequence. Before we understand homosexuality, we've got a lot of work to do. We're not even close. Okay, this is my big, big caution to you. This is what I want you to be very, very careful about. Avoid simplistic explanations and avoid dichotomies which attribute this complex behavior to just one ingredient. There are people out there who say, it's all genes. It's in my genes. It's genetic. I was born this way. It was genetically predetermined. And that's just the way it is. There are other people out there who say, it's choice. It's all a choice. It's just a choice. If you're homosexual, it's because you chose to be. And that's just as simplistic, and that's just as wrong. It's much more complex, and we have to consider many variables in the right proportions. When you come across simplistically, it's like saying, no, a cake is all sugar. No, 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 a cake is all flour. And what's the best treatment? We still don't know that. I think, and this is just my opinion, in light of the other assumptions that I've given you and the evidence that I've shown you, I think that the best treatments for reorienting people and helping them to deal with same-sex attraction is going to be a multimodal or multidimensional treatment. Probably the more of these things that you treat, the better. Or keep in mind, one person may have 3 or 4 of these factors. Another person may have 3 or 4 different factors. They may overlap on 2 or 3. So the more factors that we can address or treat, the more likely we are to have comprehensive and effective responses to help people make the change out of same-sex attraction.